now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I'm Phil Lairness, and down under, this is Mujahideen Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, Phil, how are you? It's good to be awake. Monday is happening, so there will be a Monday for everyone, I would suggest.
I have a more exciting announcement, which is year 12 of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour begins right now, and
wow.
As so many shows begin, it begins with celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
We have two people to celebrate today. One hits very, very close to home, a personal friend of ours. But first, Michael Anderson, British director, died at the age of 98. That is a good long life,
wow.
My friend. Boy, his career, I don't even know where we begin, but we'll begin at the start, I guess. Unless you want to begin at the ending, he died of heart disease on April 25th in British Columbia on the Sunshine Coast.
Oh,
there,
look at that!
That's a
good place to retire.
Ripe old age of 98. His filmography included the war epic The Dam Busters, which I think was the first film ever to cast Patrick McGoohan, by the way. If for no other reason, it's an important film. He was born into a theatrical family in London in 1920. Michael Anderson served in the army during World War II and made his feature debut in 1949 with Private Angelo, which was co-directed by one of your favorites, Dean Peter Ustinov.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Which, ironically, he also then appeared in Logan's Run.
Directed by Michael Anderson, of course.
See? Full circle.
But again, Anderson's career really took off with the 1955 war adventure, The Dam Busters. It told the story of a bombing raid on Germany's industrial heartland. It had visual flair. It had a stirring musical score. It became one of Britain's best-loved war films. And its thrilling climax inspired the attack on the Death Star in the first Star Wars movie. We are going to talk so much about Star Wars and other franchises in this show that it seems only appropriate to salute Michael Anderson for his influence on that franchise. He followed the Dam Busters with the big budget all-star adventure Around the World in 80 Days. It can be overlooked in the wake of that being one of the weakest Best Picture winners of all time and a film that won entirely through payola. I mean, the producer of that film, there were no rules against like gifts and things to Academy members back then. And if I remember correctly, the producer of that film actually took every Academy member out to a meal to campaign for that film. A year. I mean, he spent a whole year, campaigning for this movie. But it is easy to overlook in the wake of, kind of the flimsiness of that film and the overtly political campaigning that went on for it, that it nevertheless is a fun film with a lot of style and panache. And
cameos.
Michael Anderson deserves a great deal of credit for that. He was Oscar nominated for Best Director for the film. He made 36 features in all, including the thrillers Operation Crossbow and The Quiller Memorandum. And, of course, as you mentioned, the cult favorite. I won't call it a classic exactly. I think that would be wrong. But nevertheless, a fun movie with, again, a certain amount of panache. Logan's Run, a 1976 sci-fi film about a youth-obsessed future society.
Right, so, that it has an early Tinder thing. There's the three-dimensional Tinder where Michael York finds his co-star, basically, through a hookup three-dimensional holograph thing that comes to life, and then they go have sex. That was pretty advanced for 1976.
Everything I learned about the world, I learned from Star Trek, except for dating, which I learned from Logan's Run.
That's sad.
Now, to bring the room down a little bit, one of the nicest guys, genuinely just warm, big-hearted men I think either of us have ever known, George Baker, who we got to know because he ran a film festival, one of several film festivals he actually ran, there in Modesto called Shocker Fest. You and I attended up there. We had a road trip one year. We went up there, and on another year, Spectres won a whole bunch of awards up there. And he died on May 1st. He was 67 years old. A beloved family man. We know his wonderful wife of 47 years, Louise. Daughter and son and grandson, truly a free spirit, always driven to do something new. He was a disc jockey, a woodworker, a writer, a screenwriter, a filmmaker, a local TV show host, and a painter. Our friend George Baker. I was very, very sad. I learned this because I went to just, I was moved to drop him a line went to his Facebook page and saw a post. It's always odd when somebody posts as that Facebook page. So it was George Baker announcing the sad news that George Baker has died, which is kind of how I want to go out. Like, I want to go out remembering me and celebrity deaths. But then the question would be, well, who's the celebrity?
Right. See?
Anyway, George Baker, we salute you and we thank you for your friendship and for supporting independent film there in Modesto.
Love it. Thank you so much.
I want to talk about movies. Oh boy, do I want to talk about movies. But first, can we touch base on a couple of television series here?
Yes. Let's do that. What are you watching?
Did you ever catch season one of the terrific Westworld on HBO?
No. We caught one episode, I guess the start of season two, and because
you
we were in the middle of it.
On season two. All right. Yes, you do need to watch season one. Yes, you really, really do. This is a show that plays out on multiple timelines. And of course, the whole first season is about the Da Vinci-esque bicameral mind. And the show really does achieve consciousness in the second season. Not only here is a show that embodies structurally, narratively, the story of its characters, which is always heartening. And the show itself has truly, it was a very fun, fascinating show in year one. It has downright achieved consciousness and may just be the soul of television at this point in time. More
what?
Will be revealed. Two other HBO shows that I need to mention real quick. We got a text from Maddie Giles, who eagerly awaits any questions you have about Detroit.
Boy.
But he asked whether or not I thought Judd Apatow was a little too close to the material in making the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling a 4.5 hour, 2-part documentary. He thought maybe there's a 90-minute or a 2-hour documentary in there. The kind of question which I always hate, because of course there is. There's a 30-minute documentary in it. There's an 18-hour documentary in it. Would it be better? Right. No.
It's a trailer.
Maddie could not be more wrong. If anything, the problem with the show is that it's nowhere near long enough. I do think structurally it needed to be probably 2 2-hour shows, or you go 8 1-hour shows. The film, again, needs to embody the themes it's expressing. Narratively, structurally, it needs to embody that. A 90-minute or 2-hour show would be to ignore all the patterning that they are talking about textually and that they are revealing subtextually. You need to have these conversations weave back and forth through the decades. But I would say we are at a time, clearly in the wake of, for example, O.J. Made in America, which wins an Oscar for Best Documentary and is 10 hours long, where we can have 10-hour documentaries, and we should,
right,
if the topic is worthy, and this certainly was. What I think is where Maddie has his finger on something is that structurally Judd Apatow has often got himself into trouble. He is not a great filmmaker in the editing room.
Right.
And so it is, it's all there, but he lets you start to question those things. And inevitably, we live in an age where the answer always is, when you know that something isn't quite right here, is, oh, we should cut stuff out. We should cut it down.
Right.
That's always the note you get, right? Is, we can trim
this
it.
This isn't working.
We
cut
can
it
trim
out.
It. Yeah, this isn't working.
Yeah.
The answer is never, this isn't working, let's build it out. And
right.
Yet,
or find the pacing.
Exactly. And yet, better work often comes from building it out.
Right.
And part of that is because of technology making every decision so much easier to make quickly that it becomes harder to have a real handle on the pacing of the
Absolutely.
Material that you're making.
Though one of the best notes I remember sitting in the editing room at the Fox lot when they were cutting some X-Files stuff is one of the senior editors said, oh, we got to let this scene breathe. And that was lengthening some shots and not making it so quick cut and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. That's exactly
it. You know,
then,
yeah. Yeah. She said, we got to let this scene breathe a bit. And you're like, that's a neat concept, you know, of letting just some air in there, some timing, which if you watch the X-Files, you go, oh yeah, there's a lot of scenes that, you know, they linger, seemingly linger, but it's in fact having the whole scene breathe so that you have that dramatic tension and suspense build. So I haven't seen this Judd Apatow thing. I don't know if it needs suspense, but it sounds like it needs to breathe.
Yeah, especially if you're going to embody the comedy of Gary Shandling.
Yeah, right.
Right?
It's
Which
true.
Is always
yeah.
about the slow burn and the discomfort of it. Absolutely. I think it's interesting. I've been noticing more and more recently among really great filmmakers from around the world, in every country, including America, how many are starting to gravitate towards the long take. We've moved through all the quick cutting, and people are starting to realize, filmmakers are starting to realize, that the response to low attention spans, the need to let things breathe, is probably best achieved through longer takes. And if you're doing longer
right.
takes with less coverage, you don't have to worry about the studio notes of, oh, well, cut out of the shot. Well, you don't have coverage to go to, so they're stuck with it. And lo and behold,
yes.
that's what reveals the mood, the tone, the character. And I'm starting to see this more and more.
and particularly with technology, you know, you think about Birdman and the shots in the hallway and Michael Keaton going out in Times Square where he's locked out and running around in his underwear. Like, that long shot was probably, you know, 4 or 5 days of different shots all wove together through the magic of technology. And so it's a seemingly single shot, similar to Daniel Craig in the James Bond opener set in Mexico at a Day of the Dead sure. parade, where then he has to go up the stairs. And
Inspector, yes.
Yeah. And that opening shot, I mean, that's an amazing piece of filmmaking.
In many different kinds of genres, we're seeing longer takes. Think about it. Think about how exciting it is. In action, you want to feel you are there. Boots on the ground, you are there, and you want to believe that it's the person you're watching doing it. John Wick has a lot of really elaborately choreographed long takes. In drama, you want to feel that you are experiencing what the characters are experiencing.
Oh my God.
You don't want it created for you. As I've been advocating for almost 3 decades now, master shots are democratic and coverage is fascist because you are directing the audience's attentions and emotions as opposed to letting them choose how to explore something.
So that brings us right then to the Avengers Infinity Wars.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Why do you talking about structurally embodying something? No, we've been we've established for weeks now that we're going to get into franchise discussion later on in the show. Why would you jump from television all the way down? So finally, the other TV show on HBO that I want to mention is The Return of Silicon Valley, which had really hit its peak and which I'm only a few episodes into this season. I will continue to go a couple more, but Jump the Shark is very much coming to mind. Not being able to recalibrate after the departure of T.J. Miller, it's the balance is entirely thrown off, and what that show kind of ended up being at its heart, which is about the Thomas Middleditch character constantly attracting and seeking mentor figures that he was reluctant to embrace and then who end up screwing him over, causing him to always fall back in some way on the support of T.J. Miller's character, Ehrlich Bachman, who always comes through, but often not in the way he thinks he's going to or in the way that he would want to. And now, lacking that character, there's a huge hole where, again, the show's soul kind of needs to be. Is it funny? Of course. It can't not be funny, but it feels like a show that's going through the motions in some ways, just trying to find a way to stay relevant. So,
Now, didn't they replace TJ's character with another character that had the same function?
No. And I don't think they could. And they've tried that once before when they've lost, when an actor died, and they were able to replace the plot function. But in terms of relationship, no, they have not been able to do that. Let's see if something happens. They do say they're going to be introducing a chief operating officer character. Again, I'm a few episodes behind, so I will revisit this if they turn it around. But it does not bode well at this point. Okay, the Cannes Film Festival starts this week. Big, big event annually in cinema. And in honor of the Cannes Film Festival starting, I finally caught last year's Cannes winner of the Palme d'Or, a film that you have seen and you have wrestled with on this show, not knowing whether you loved it or you hated it. And that is from Sweden, Ruben Östlund's The Square. And this was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. And it comes from the filmmaker who made one of a handful of the truly great films of this decade, Force Majeure. And like Force Majeure, it is a satire. Unlike Force Majeure, it picks, I think, fairly easy, broad topics And
yeah.
Or at least not easy. Let's not say easy. Nothing about satire is easy, but broad. And it hits them in scattershot, buckshot fashion too often. It does not have a laser focus. But this is a film where you said that there is a sequence that comes, a fairly lengthy sequence that comes somewhere near the middle of the film. And it is so, do you remember this? And it is so affecting. I that's my word. I don't know what your word was exactly, but it affected you to such a great degree that it rendered everything that led up to it, I don't know, it put it in a totally different perspective, and then it made you disconnected from everything that followed. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, without being spoiler alert, it is a performance art piece in the center for a gallery fundraiser. And the essence of the performance art piece is the basic theme of the movie itself. But the performance arts piece does so much better in encapsulating that theme that the rest of the movie seems clumsy. I'm thinking I'm using the word now. Clumsy ill thought out. There seems to be a lot of post-production scrambling after seeing the imbalance of that centerpiece with the rest of the movie. That's what I saw in retrospect, including... It feels like once they had some traction, they brought in Elizabeth Moss as an afterthought to the whole script. So to me, there was huge argument thought. There was post-production issues that they tried to solve with extra reshoots, editing, as we've been talking about, and all sorts of things. So the more I thought about this, the more I thought, oh, my gosh. These filmmakers, as brilliant as they are, were scrambling with the footage that they had.
Here's an interesting thing. I know for a fact that that is not true about Elizabeth Moss being brought in after the fact, and I'll explain to you how I know that. But what I think is fascinating is you actually put your finger on exactly how it does feel, which really begs the question of what the hell went wrong if it feels like something you tacked on after the fact. But I know that it was in there because Elizabeth Moss and Klaus Bang, the lead actor, who is terrific in his first
fantastic.
Lead. It is an actor in his 50s, acclaimed theater actor and monologuist, I believe. But his first lead role in a film, and he's terrific. And indeed... the film actually works best as a character study of this man. He's very real. And I almost wish that this was two different films. I do wish that there was a satire of the museum, per se, and then a workplace film that was about this character and that embodied his character more fully, instead of imposing satirical ideas upon him. Which is what too often feels the way. But with Elizabeth Moss and Klaus Bang, they had to go through elaborate training on how to stay safe in the face of that unique, I forget the name of the kind of small chimpanzee that's in the film. But remember that she has...
Ape.
Yeah, she'll, exactly. She has as a roommate this young chimpanzee. And so they did have to go through elaborate training of it in advance so that they could stay safe.
However, I guess it's an echo of the performance art piece, but it seemed that to me, just having the ape in there almost rendered that to me felt like filmmakers scrambling.
Well, on paper, it makes sense. You can see the idea. It's a three-act structure. The ape's in there three times. The middle time, it's played by Terry Notary in the performance art piece. Terry Notary, who, of course, does so many of the great ape performances in the Planet of the Apes movies.
Right.
But it really is two different films. And the one that follows Klaus Bang is not perfected at all. And it's really disappointing coming in the wake of Force Majeure. That performance art piece is absolutely brilliant and reminded me of the movie that I've been hailing for quite some time, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence. That's exactly what that movie is, but that movie pulls it off for 2 hours. So, an interesting thing. And for this movie to win the Palme d'Or really smacks me of, okay, we've already decided we are going to coronate this filmmaker after the brilliant force majeure so that he can get acclaim, particularly in the West. And indeed, The Square did much better box office than Force Majeure did. So anyway, I guess the takeaway is watch. It's an interesting failure, certainly, but definitely made me appreciate Force Majeure all the more, and just how hard it is to completely close your fist on a satire.
Yeah, for sure. So, okay, so we agree then.
Yeah, yeah. And I finally, okay. finally saw that. Two other older movies, two old movies that I saw that I was surprised by my reactions to, because they were almost exactly the opposite of what I expected. I had never seen 1955's juvenile delinquent drama in the classroom classic by Richard Brooks, The Blackboard Jungle. I had never seen that before. Even though I really like Glenn Ford, and of course, a big Sidney Poitier fan, that's one of his first performances. Right. The takeover.
Jamie Farr.
Was he? Was he in that? I guess he was one of the young guys. But the real takeaway for me is Vic Morrow as one of the juvenile delinquents. How scary Vic Morrow was. I suddenly understand Vic Morrow's career now.
Yeah.
But boy, that movie does not age. That does not age well at all.
Is that right?
Daddy-o. And what a period. You know, that's that era of... Hollywood message movies that if you say it was a Hollywood message movie, I can tell you a movie that did not age well. On the other hand, I saw Alfred Hitchcock's 1966 follow-up to Marnie. Marnie failed at the box office. And the last film he made before Topaz, which we've talked about on this show, the rather lifeless spy movie. I guess you could call it a thriller. It attempted to without thrills.
Recreation.
But I had always heard really bad things about this movie, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. It's 1966's Torn Curtain, starring Paul Newman as a nuclear physicist, seemingly defecting to the East because he has been developing a process that will make nuclear weaponry obsolete, and American government is not interested in spending money on it. So he seemingly defects to work on it on the other side of the Iron Curtain because peace is more important than patriotism, according to him. And it becomes a tale of espionage and suspense, all of which works for me. And how stunning that in a decade where Hitchcock reinvents the murder on screen with Psycho, right? What was it, 78 cuts in 52 seconds or something like that?
Yeah,
right?
Something like that, yeah.
Making you believe you're seeing things that aren't really happening. Here, he does an almost uninterrupted 10-minute murder sequence that shows just how not only brutal, but difficult it is to actually kill someone. And it is to this day so unnerving and shocking. This is an underrated gem. And I think one of the reasons, it was a fairly successful film at the time, but I think one of the reasons it became underrated was that, one, it was the era of James Bond and people wanted Paul Newman in a James Bond film, and Hitchcock was not interested in this. This is a movie with dialogue and suspense. But Paul Newman himself and Alfred Hitchcock did not really get along. Not surprisingly, Newman of the method, Alfred Hitchcock of I didn't say actors were cattle. I said they should be treated like cattle.
right.
But Newman, for his part, said he felt like he and Hitchcock would have gotten along, but the script kept getting in the way. But this is the film where famously, when Newman kept asking him what his motivation was, Hitchcock famously said, "Your paycheck." And but he's doing some good work. I mean, that friction between them actually put, I think,
adds
life.
To the tension.
Yeah, exactly. And it adds life to it in a way that I felt neither Marnie, though an interesting film, and nor certainly Topaz, where everyone's doing it Hitchcock's way, neither of those had the kind of tension and energy that this film did. So am I saying it's one of his masterpieces? No, but I am saying that it's an underrated late career gem. And given the paltry selection of modern day espionage movies, as we've talked about and might talk about again in a few minutes, looking back to when the Cold War actually existed and still having some of those to discover, certainly makes me happy.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to check that out. I don't think I've seen it since I was a young child. And so a lot of my memories of it are hazy at best. So on my list.
Finally, something playing right now, I think on Showtime, made a lot of top 10 lists last year. It's an independent film from England called Lady Macbeth. And it is a star-making tour return by its young lead, Florence Pugh, who's outstanding, and directed by, I think, first-time filmmaker William Oldroyd. And stop me if you've heard this before, a period England, young bride sold into marriage, a loveless marriage, husband's away, she enters into a passionate affair. Even as the story develops very little beyond that, and even though I kept asking myself, haven't I literally seen this movie before? And then realized, no, it's a recent release, so it's only figuratively that I've seen this before. The work by the director and this lead actress nevertheless held me so entranced. I had not seen this particular characterization before, and then when she slowly reveals herself, I guess the title should have been a giveaway, but to be a true embodiment of toxicity, of feminine, the toxic feminine, wow. It becomes really an interesting film, and only 89 minutes long, too. So quite a dark, sinister, and therefore fun movie available on Showtime on demand right now, Lady Macbeth. We have an email from a loyal listener, Dean Haglund.
Hooray!
This comes from Stephen D. Fowler of the Swingin' All-Stars. Or is it the Smokin' All-Stars?
The Smokin'
All-Stars, of course. They swing, though. They do swing.
They swing and they smoke.
And they smoke. In that order, often. And hey, Chill Packers, first, let me say congratulations on all of your wonderful personal news. Fuzz Aldrin, the new knee, the engagement, finding a distributor, and moving to Detroit. Good on ya.
In that order, I think, is how the good news fell out.
And thanks again for the mention. Best advertising money I never spent. He's talking about Booksmith quality used books. But it reminds me that I need to catch you up on what's been happening here. Not content to be just another secondhand bookstore, I have teamed up with Dave Creasy, who used to own a video store here in Nelson, BC, and we have created the Booksmith Video Underground. All right.
Wow.
This sounds cool. All right. This consists of a well-curated collection of classic, cult, and foreign films, as well as a six-seat cinema.
Ah, fantastic.
Patrons can either rent the room and watch a film, or they can rent the films and take them home. It's been up and running for about a month, and we're already breaking even on it.
Wow.
I also, and this
let me get this.
Well, this is what we were talking about the curated approach really stands out in this day and age if people can find out about it.
Right. Yeah. So I'm trying to picture a six-seat theater, and then they're personally selecting the films. I suspect a double bill, perhaps, so that you can get
your coffee. You rent it out. You rent it out, and it's a well-curated collection of films. So I bet you have choices. Within that.
I see. Right. Okay. It.
But Stephen D. Fowler, if you're within the sound of my voice, please send us more details. If there's a website about this, would love to talk about it. Hell, would love to come and host a night at that thing. Hell, I just want to relocate and just live in the six-seat cinema.
In Revelstoke.
Nelson. In Nelson, British Columbia. All right.
In Nelson, right. Not Revelstoke.
But this... is where he segues into the bulk of what we're going to talk about on this show. I also had a couple thoughts about Star Wars and its enduring popularity. The idea, one that I expressed via a co-presenter on the Midweek Drive a couple weeks ago, the idea that the new generations are discovering the underlying myths of Star Wars, as explained by one of your listeners, is very perceptive and I think accurate. Another factor is that Star Wars is really the last common cultural touchstone, certainly in North America. Whether you love it or hate it or couldn't care less about it, you've at least heard of it and probably can name a few, if not all, of the major characters. This is a great point. It really
is. That is a great point.
It has benefited from the disintegration of common popular frames of reference. In a way that no other franchise really stepped up to do. That is fascinating.
Right.
We all know more about Star Wars than we do about every other movie franchise, and it's that familiarity that has allowed it to keep its place in the cultural consciousness. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before, and I will be again, but in this case, I don't think so. Keep up the good work, and stop worrying so much about running overtime. You need to put more chill in the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, Stephen D. Fowler and the Smokin' All-Stars Booksmith, Quality Used Books, 338 Baker Street, Nelson, British Columbia. That's fascinating. That is the other piece of the puzzle. People seem to enjoy, Dean, when I talked about The Last Jedi. I think it was last week.
Tore it to pieces.
And I pointed out that it was, I didn't tear it to pieces. It might be as good a work as we can expect. That's what I said. But I also pointed out that, it's falsehood in advertising because it won't be The Last Jedi. They'll make more. What's interesting about it, though, is that my argument about how it's introducing these myths, at the same time, it is the movie that really kind of abandons the mythology in that, Luke Skywalker, spoiler alert, becoming one with the Force at the end was always the end game of Star Wars. In fact, it was George Lucas's end game. But, of course, it's where Episode 9 was supposed to end under George Lucas's curation. Anyway.
Right.
Or direction, rather. But
curation. Curation, I think, is a better term.
But because it had become just a museum of ideas, really, and props and toys and all these sort of things. And occasionally the curation would lead you into a story point. But by doing it in Episode 8, it basically, in a way, says, this overarching mythology that you really thought you were exploring, we don't have that much interest in. We're interested in just opening up the universe in new ways. So they pretty much eradicate everything. And then, partly not due to their own choices, but I mean, it's clearly set up that if Harrison Ford was the legacy actor who got to play the lead in Episode 7, and Mark Hamill was the legacy actor who got to play the lead in Episode 8, even though they could both come back as ghosts or force figures in Episode 9, it was Carrie Fisher's turn to be the legacy actor with the lead role in Episode 9, and that ain't gonna happen. So partly because of forces out of their control, but also largely in a way that set up everything about the rebellion and the resistance is gone. It's a handful of people. We get to start really anew, and we get to do whatever story we want. And that was their end game. That was J.J. Abrams' end game, clearly, all along. So episode 9 is not going to be so much episode 9 as probably the launch of whatever they want it to be after this. And maybe that's okay. Maybe I'm already at the point where I care less about that than I do about these other standalone movies that explore the nooks and crannies and open up the Star Wars universe more, like Rogue One or like the forthcoming Solo with the terrific Alden Ehrenreich.
Right, who you championed ever since Hail Caesar as the next Han Solo.
Yes, and then he got cast. Indeed.
Yeah, I know.
And of course, we both liked him in that. We liked him in that Warren Beatty movie. Also, Rules Don't Apply. We thought he was.
Rules Don't Apply. That's right.
But
he was really good.
I see no reason why the Solo movie couldn't be terrific, and it is a very smart thing that they're doing in terms of opening up the universe. It's an entire universe.
Right.
There is no shortage of stories they could tell.
Hello, how many authors have been writing not just Star Wars novels? I'm thinking of Timothy Hahn, who had a whole entire universe built around Star Wars that, of course, J.J. Jettisons, but had legions of fans following that one and had, a long career. I know I have quite a few of those books, and it's so not just obvious, but necessary, because once you are a fan of the Star Wars thing, you really your mind just can't help but wander into that whole universe far, far away, long, long time ago.
Speaking of the other J.J. Abrams franchise, Star Trek, it's something that Star Trek has always wrestled with, at times has embraced, at other times hasn't, and it's really become tricky for it, which is about, are we clinging to mythology, or are we expanding and opening up the universe? The first spinoff, Next Generation, the universe begins anew. And yet it has a certain familiarity, just like the Star Wars standalones get to have. Deep Space Nine. Yes, it's set in the same timeline as Next Generation, so it's familiar, and you can have crossovers, and you can tie it into what's going on and into past storylines. But we also get to open up entirely new cultures and an entirely new quadrant. So it is, at the same time, again, literally, the story point is we're opening up the universe. When they make the fourth show, they want to do the same thing. So Voyager gets lost in another part of space. And I think the feeling was it wasn't familiar enough. And therefore, we got to dial back in future iterations on boldly going quite so far or so boldly. And maybe it was, one, a little bit of overkill, and two, maybe the characters as originally conceived weren't actually that interesting. Next Generation struggled with that in the first season, but it was the only game in town, so it had time to really find its footing, and when it did, people came to it. But by Voyager, even when it improved, I think a lot of people were going, well, you know what? I've had my fill of Star Trek. I don't need more. So, But as is often the case when you're dealing with franchises and risk management, they swung the pendulum all the way back towards, okay, we want this to pretend to be unfamiliar, but we want it to tie in with everything you know. So let's go back to the beginning and see how things lead into the Federation you know. And isn't that exactly what they're doing again with Discovery?
Yeah.
And so then J.J. Abrams comes along for the big screen, right? We're going to create a whole new timeline. Well, that's not really opening up the universe, because that's taking everything you love and making you feel comfortable, making you know what's going on here. You don't have to spend 10 minutes trying to figure out who characters are. You don't have to do any work. You know who they are. And then
right.
you get to enjoy how we just basically take the game board and shake it up.
Right.
And
so you think Discovery's doing that?
Well, I certainly think the J.J. Abrams movies are.
Movies, yeah.
And there's and when they did it effectively with the first one, the question then was, okay, what do you do now? Are you going to tell
right.
stories? And they said, no, we're just going to keep taking your favorite game pieces and we're going to just keep shaking them up.
Around.
And and it was not, lo and behold, it was met with some ambivalence. Even if it was well done, it was met with ambivalence. What's fascinating is the crossroads Star Trek is at now in terms of the movie franchise, because they announced not one, but two new, officially, two new Star Trek films. It turns out that for the first time, a woman will be directing a Star Trek feature, and I am so sorry that I don't have my notes handy. I cannot remember her name. She directed, among other things, the pilot of Jessica Jones. She's a terrific director, and so this is very exciting news, but it was asked, well, we thought Tarantino was going to direct, and the head of Paramount,
I read that.
The head of Paramount made it very clear, no, that's the other Star Trek movie.
Oh.
So she will be directing the Simon Pegg originated script that is part four of this Kelvin universe timeline, which finally brings back together Chris Pine as Kirk and Chris Hemsworth as his father. Right? Remember,
that's cool.
Remember pre-Thor, Chris Hemsworth played Kirk's father in the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek because he lost out to Chris Pine for the role of Captain Kirk. And they then said, who do we get to play as dad? Oh, why not our second choice? And both guys become stars, so now they're sitting pretty, and part four will be...
The director you're thinking of is S.J. Clarkson.
Okay.
S.J. Clarkson.
So this,
from Jessica Jones.
So this will be the... This will be the fourth film. But at the same time,
right.
Tarantino is developing one that has already been given a green light that he will direct. He's got other movies he's working on first. And apparently, it is a whole different timeline. Tarantino, as he did with The West in Django Unchained, as he did with World War II in Inglourious Basterds, I think we can expect him to literally reconfigure the history of Star Trek and say, who cares? Who cares that this is not, what's the word when something is not according to the strict rules of the...
canon.
It's not canon. Yeah, who cares if it's not canon? Let's make a good movie.
Right. And then use that as to explore metaphors and themes and issues of humanity, which is always what Star Trek did in the first place. So why not have Tarantino, who, you know, always goes to extreme dark edges, to Django about racism and World War II, about revenge and all of that fantasy, you know? I think that is going to be something where everybody will have to embrace it just by the sheer force of a Tarantino movie.
And it's exactly the thing that could finally bust the doors off the narrowing of the Star Trek universe. How does a whole universe start to feel small and claustrophobic when it's Star Trek?
No.
And this could bust the doors off of it in the way that Star Wars has done. Because the opportunity was always there. They really missed the boat with Star Trek. I mean, as I always said, there should have been a television miniseries or a Netflix miniseries revisiting Deep Space Nine, because there were so many story threads that you could have explored. There was one time when there was talk about this, and why not a TV series Captain Sulu, exploring his adventures.
Right.
People would have loved it.
Yeah.
How about an independent film, a low-budget independent film about Captain Worf on the Defiant? You could modulate the budget sizes and the releases based on the characters, and you could have expanded the universe with all this material,
yes,
the way that Star Wars has done so effectively. And Tarantino finally might be creating that opportunity, especially because the rumors are all of a sudden you got Patrick Stewart, William Shatner, several other people, the J.J. Abrams cast, all saying, yeah, we're on board. Wait, you're on board all in the same movie? What do you know? How are all these things possible? Well, they're all possible. They're only limited by imagination. And say what we will about Tarantino, his imagination is not limited.
That's true.
So,
but I'm going to, you know, I think there is one reason, because there has been independent films to try and expand the Star Trek universe that have been shut down by Paramount, owner of the franchise.
Well, no, I understand that. But Paramount needed to make them independently scaled movies, right? They always have been playing this from what we talk about, risk management. And what you got to love about Disney with the Star Wars franchise is, quite frankly, let's open this up. We paid a huge amount of money for it. Let's get our money's worth. Let's not protect our investment. Let's make the most of our investment. And
almost like open source, open source filmmaking.
You want to talk about a franchise that also had the opportunity to create a universe that could be explored, but every decision since season 7 onward has been about narrowing it, was the X-Files.
Yes.
I mean, the last time we tried to expand it was with a Lone Gunman spinoff. And almost in response to that experience, the powers that be with the X-Files, every creative decision has been to narrow the universe. We used to talk about why not a return series that focuses on William, and if Gillian Anderson and Duchovny want to come by and be a part of it, they can. But what about exploring what this kid would be like walking through the world? There's a show, and you don't even need to have been an X-Files fan to be interested in that show. That could be the entree for a new generation, for crying out loud. And indeed, the character, when we finally find him, is interesting. So by all means, fucking kill him off as fast as possible. Oh, wait. No, maybe he survived at the end. You know what? I don't care. Every choice you've made to keep it going has been to keep a narrower and narrower thread of it going.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the season 11 wasn't good. As you know, I thought much of it was remarkable, and I thought thematically it was fairly interesting. But what I am saying is that the overall approach for almost two decades now towards it has not been one of opening and becoming more inclusive, which is where we had that for that brief shining opportunity. Where we looked like we were heading with the Lone Gunman, which did find a tone, which did exist in the universe, which was just hitting the ground running when the plug got pulled. And again, the response was, well, we're not going to do that again.
Well, because also so much pressure from the feedback was, what are the answers? We need the answers to these mysteries. When in fact, no one wanted the answers to the mysteries. We wanted the mysteries and the relationships to continue. And so the more they attempted to try and answer some stuff and leave it open-ended, the smaller the universe became.
Well, which this is getting back to Star Wars, this is what you always advocated. You know, how many stories are in those opening title crawl sequences?
Right.
Instead of worrying about giving people answers, how about answering fascinating questions they didn't even know to ask.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
If you keep, you know, we live in this world where everyone wants answers. Everyone wants answers. Everyone wants answers. Whereas storytellers, what we need to start doing is asking more interesting questions in response to that.
Absolutely.
So Star Wars opens the universe. Star Trek desperately wants to do it, whether or not it's too late. We'll see if anybody can pull it off. Like we said, it's Tarantino. But that brings us to another now, you know, Disney franchise, which is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And
yes,
this has been about standalone stories and characters and expanding that universe. Hell, Marvel Cinematic Universe was part of Marvel Cinematic Universe. And right, the entire effort culminates in a two-part movie called Infinity War. The first part was released a week ago. The second part is released a year from now and picks up exactly 1 second after the ending of part one. And
right,
and as such, part one kind of feels like a trailer for part two.
Holy shit, does it ever.
But
did you see it?
Yes.
Did you go see this?
Yes. So yes, I want to talk about this, but the other thing that I want to throw in here to think about is there are many standalone Marvel movies coming out between now and Infinity War. And in very right, interesting fashion, they are all being set prior to Infinity War. And I kind of like the boldness of that. I like them saying, you know what? The audience doesn't care. The audience is fine knowing that these are set before, and they will enjoy these stories.
Right.
And
this is very much the model of how comic books go anyway. I mean, think about it. You can go back and forth with your Spider-Mans and your Iron Mans and all that sort of thing. And fans of each will follow these tangents in comic book form. So it makes sense that you would follow it in the same way in the movie form.
It, you know, as opposed to what has often been done in the past, right? You have a big hit, and then you know what we're going to do? We're going to release part two 3 months later or 2 months later, which would have been gargantuan box office, no question. But I also would argue that it's a little bit risky depending on how that one ends, because if that is the swan song, certainly for several of these actors whose contracts expire, people could walk out a little bit sad, and that could color other standalone films. But also, if it's not satisfying, that could color other standalone films. Think about The Matrix. Matrix, huge hit. Wouldn't it have been fascinating to explore that universe of The Matrix and how things were affected within The Matrix by the events of the first film, but explore how things are different through other characters?
Yes, all those other pods. Would there not be other rebellions going on?
Yes.
I mean,
Or people clinging to it. Right?
I mean,
you could have had such wonderful thematic exploration, and it wouldn't have had to be an action. You could have made a great TV series, a Matrix TV series that does not involve Neo and Lawrence Fishburne's character, for example, or Trinity.
Or
Morpheus, right? And Trinity.
Yeah, Morpheus.
And then you can always bring that back in the movie form, but instead it was all about this two-part dance marathon that we're going to release months apart from each other, and it crushes all the opportunity and all the life out of it.
I'm still arguing they didn't even realize what they had. I don't think they knew thematically till somebody pointed out afterwards, you know, thematically this movie's about that. And they went, oh, shit, we thought it was all just special effects and action and shit. So they, were completely focused elsewhere. It could be, it felt like that they, the movie intuitively fell upon a theme that no one realized was there.
So what do you feel about, we're in agreement on it feeling like a trailer. They knew where this was heading.
Yes.
The Russo brothers are good filmmakers. They've done great work in the Marvel Universe. It's a little bit, you're not directors on a movie like this. You're traffic cops. And they're keeping the plate spinning. They're keeping the characters sort of straight. And they're given as many moments as they can.
Right. But it's so many plates. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. When you see a plate spinner and he's got maybe five or seven, that's exciting. When the plate spinner has 24 or 29, I forget how many were, you're not even really that impressed anymore. It's like, oh, it seems plate spinning seems to be an easy thing to do because you have 29 of them on stage at the same time. So the thing to me was that you're just bored with the amount of violence and the amount of explosions, and you literally are rendered to the point where you don't care. It's like, oh, somebody died, whatever. I was bored through that thing. And I enjoyed many of the movies following up to this. I thought it was
preferable to Age of Ultron, the second Avengers movie. I found this preferable. I think maybe because at least I know, you know, this is the end game. At least we are in the end game now.
Yeah.
What I said is part one of the, you know, the Harry Potter two-part finale. That's what it is. And the proof is going to be in the pudding of part two. And you know what I would love to see, and I'm never going to see it, right? But wouldn't it be fantastic if part two is ultimately not about action, and it's about creativity, inventiveness, teamwork, intelligence, intuition, saving the day.
Wouldn't that be something? That'd be fun.
And the movie that we need right now.
Yeah, honestly. For sure, because we don't need everybody expressing themselves through sniping at each other, violence, just as the go-to emotional line is just rage and anger throughout the whole thing. It's like,
especially in the wake of Black Panther. You know how I felt about Black Panther. I felt like an old dude in the theater. I don't love it the way that everyone else loves it, but I appreciate how much everybody loves it, and I do appreciate the film's social consciousness and heart.
Right.
And both of which are lacking in this movie. Infinity. But again, I don't want to criticize this too much because it's a trailer for the next movie.
And every scene felt like a trailer, too. That was the weird part.
I think Alex Levchuk even said that the whole movie felt like a trailer for the ending of the movie.
Yeah. But even the ending of the movie was the trailer for the next one.
Yeah, so well, there like, you go.
Oh. Yeah.
We are putting the chill in Chill Pack Hollywood Hour in year 12 because we are over time. But I want to finish up with a couple questions for you. I was curious about what you thought apropos of these franchises. And everything is a discussion for these huge entertainment
locomotives.
These entertainment conglomerates, that's what they want. They want product locomotives. They want franchises. They want tentpole franchises. And so we don't talk about genres really anymore. Do you remember studios used to always make sure that they checked off their boxes, that they diversified their portfolio because that was a smart investment, right? Remember that? Diversify portfolio. That's how you make money. Well, that's how these very smart businessmen, because they were businessmen back then who ran the studios, made sure that the studios stayed profitable was by making sure that they delivered in every genre that it had been proven people love. Well, we haven't disproven any genres these days. All we've proven is that genres aren't necessarily four quadrant hits, so therefore we don't even swing for them anymore.
Right.
And as a result, I'm curious, right? Is there a future for Westerns? Occasionally we'll have a Western because so many big movie stars love them and because so many directors love them. So occasionally we'll have them, and there should be a future for it. I would argue now more than ever. I mean, the mythology and psychology and the way those intertwine of America's history is more relevant now than ever before. So let's get in there and do that work Yes, Westerns are incredibly relevant.
Important,
but,
yeah.
But we're not going to get them.
And we're not going to get them.
I said, with the exception of an occasional one, and because these are not people who regularly use the Western genre, a la a Clint Eastwood, they're just going to be standalone movies that are aiming for the four quadrant success, or they're going to be independent films from Australia, where often the Westerns are coming from these days.
So there's still some West out here.
So not much of a future for Westerns.
No.
What about comedies? Not only financially do I think there is no future for studio comedies, because the studios have all decided that they don't sell internationally. And if they don't sell internationally, then why do we bother making them? But I also think politically in America, no future for them anymore, because this is the degree
we're
to
sensitive.
Which this is the degree to which we are an entire nation of snowflakes. Nobody can laugh at anything anymore, for crying out loud.
Right. Right. That our degree of offending, our offending nerve is rubbed raw and bare, so that anything that even is slightly risque is now offensive. And so your double entendre, whatever that was, your go-to comedy bits in the past now rings as out-and-out hatred or misogyny or whatever offensive thing you are offended by.
Well, I mean, so, the Amy Schumer movie, I'm So Pretty, comes out, and people criticize it for so many things. I would criticize it for not actually being very good or very funny, but but the criticisms drive me nuts. And Bill Maher did a big piece on this week, and I won't get into all the criticisms leveled against it. But one of them is, that it shouldn't have been, a white lead. It should have been about diversity. It should have been this. It should have been other things. It's all about criticizing the movie for what it's not, rather than for what it is. And what it is mm-hmm. the new Amy Schumer movie. So why wouldn't it star Amy Schumer?
Right.
We should have Amy Schumer movies. We should have Kevin Hart movies. We should have Will Ferrell movies. We should have comedy movies. But I don't think we're going to. I think we're going to have fewer and fewer all the time. So,
well, and they also signed these deals. So Adam Sandler is delivering on his sixth of his six picture deal with Kevin Hart. Called, what was that one? Every Beginning Week?
With Chris Rock. Not Kevin Hart. Chris Rock,
yes.
Yeah, and it's Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all on Netflix. Yes, comedy is for television only. It's comedy is for you to watch in the comfort of your own home, not with a group of people.
Which
Ouch.
Is so wrong.
Ouch, yeah.
Ouch.
So here's the irony, Dean, because we've done so many top 10 shows about genres of films. Here's the irony. The genre that I don't think just stands the best chance, but I think is going to come back full bore, guns blazing, is the musical.
No.
Because here's your product locomotive. Thanks to generations raised on Disney animated films and MTV and shows like Glee, musicals are all potential four quadrant hits.
That's true, right? And the kids can enjoy it.
And the Broadway musicals are making more money than they ever did before. One of the four biggest hit films of all time was the live-action Beauty and the Beast. My problem, of course, is we have very few people in Hollywood, as evidenced by La La Land, that can sing or dance or can make movies about people who sing and dance. But you know where those people exist? In New York. On Broadway.
In New York.
And these companies will understand to import the talent. These are product locomotives. You make the Broadway musical, you turn the musical into a movie, because that continues to not only make money as a movie, but it makes sure that the musical will be around forever in revivals, making money, in touring companies, making money. Wow. It's fascinating. I think.
Well, here's hoping.
The musical's back.
Here's hoping that it's a, yeah, that we find the directors who can stage them properly.
Yeah, cinematically. Absolutely.
Cinematically,
and again,
yeah.
Wow, we're tying this back into the beginning. Movies, directors that are willing to use the long take, that are willing to show actors dancing, are willing to show the movement of the human body. The reason why people hailed, I'm not going to bash this movie again. I know people love it. But the reason that Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge did not lead to a revival of musicals was because it fundamentally wasn't a musical. It was a series of pop songs, right? It wasn't original compositions.
Yeah.
And there was no dancing.
Right.
In it, the dancing was done by the camera and was created in editing. The semiotics of human movement were not actually conveying the story. And so that's why, love it or hate it, that's why it was a standalone. It was not a, and people who tried to recreate it and repeat it, you're not able to do it because you're not Baz Luhrmann. And it's not fundamentally what a musical is all about. So
that's right.
I do think we're at that point, though, where we're going to see a revival, a full-on revival of musicals. Dean Hagland.
Wow. Can't wait.
Wow. So we get year 12 off to a flying start with 12 extra minutes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Give till it hurts.
That's right.
You can find every installment that we've done in our 11 years
ever.
In 1 week at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review.
What could be more fun? Can people like us on Facebook, Dean Hagland?
Oh, boy, can they. We're at facebook.com, chillpackhollywood. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the very same handle. That's at Dean and Phil, spell out the word and.
People can,
hashtag, we give great hashtag.
People can write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, as Stephen D. Fowler did. We love to hear from you. We love talking about what you want us to talk about. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Now, in its 12th year, as always brought to you by the good folks at Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Hagland. See you then. Intercontinental LA to Australia.
Belated spoiler alert.